Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of the You Should Run podcast. I'm your host, Tony Heil, council member in Bridgeport, Pennsylvania, which is near Philadelphia. And if you've been listening to the podcast over the past year, and I'm very excited that we're coming up to the year anniversary of when I started this. You know, I started out talking to people who were local to me, whether it's in the Philadelphia area and New Jersey. And thankfully, through friends and networking and talking to others, I've been able to hear some really awesome perspectives from across the country, including recently putting up podcasts from California and Alaska. Now, today, I'm equally excited to talk to a new friend of mine from Kansas. His name is Brett Parker. It's an easy name to pronounce, but the politics in Kansas, of course, are not easy. If you're from anywhere else in the country, you probably have your own perspectives on what Kansas is like. We often do that in the world where we kind of have our own prejudices about it's different states. We think they're too liberal, too conservative, too backwards, too this, too that. But I think Brett's going to talk about how Kansas is unique and also, hopefully, why you listening at home or wherever you are will consider running no matter where you live, because each election is important to produce good outcomes of legislation and help people's lives. So, Brett Parker is a legislative leader in Kansas. He's a Democrat. He is working to improve a lot of different issues. But most importantly, he is navigating a very difficult and interesting terrain in Kansas with conservative Republicans, moderate Republicans, and a state that is a lot different than I think any of us realize, even though it may be very flat. So, with all that in mind, Brett, thank you for joining the podcast today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be on.
So, you know, Kansas may be flat, but I did see you were just traveling all over some mountains, right?
Yeah, I was running around the national parks in Utah for most of the last week. So just got back Saturday night.
Well, I appreciate you. I'm sure you're tired. I'm tired just looking at some of the pictures you posted.
No, I'm happy to be back in the indoors and get caught up on real life.
But you're back in Kansas, and so where in Kansas are you?
I'm in the Kansas City suburbs. It's Overland Park, Kansas. It's about 4 miles from the Missouri state line, just to the southwest of Kansas City, Kansas, Kansas City, Missouri.
Now, my first political experience was in Iowa, which also borders Missouri. And I knew a lot of people who had some anti-Missouri sentiments. They would call it misery, and it just made us feel better. Is that? Do you guys try and have some interstate rivalries with the states around you?
Yeah, we do a bit, and as I've served, 3 years now, it's been fun kind of getting to know some of the political leaders on the other side of state line, and you can go back and forth on some of those issues. But, yeah, for the most part, we get along fairly well. With a sort of divided metro area, you kind of have to split where people see themselves as Kansans, but they also see themselves as Kansas Cityans, and that tends to go on both sides of the state line. So there's friendly rivalry, but we all kind of occupy the same space on the map for the most part, despite the state line running through the middle of it, so we get along all right.
Right. It's like people in Camden, New Jersey probably want to pretend they're from Philadelphia, but they're not. But like you said, you have been in office for 3 years now, and that means you were elected in 2016. What have you always been politically engaged, or did something kind of inspire you that this was the time to get involved?
Yeah, I think I was like a lot of people where I was an interested political observer. I tried to be an educated voter and follow what was going on in the world, but certainly never imagine myself really running for office until in 2014. I feel like a lot of people in Kansas had sort of like the 2016 experience 2 years early. Our state reelected Governor Sam Brownback, who had not been great for our budget or public education, and had been polling behind most of the time leading into the election, and so. As a public school teacher, I was rooting for his opponents, and I had made a handful of calls and just kind of thought, well, surely, you know, we're wiser than this as a state, and we'll move in the new direction before we see 8 years of damage instead of four. And Governor Brownback got reelected, and I was kind of left with this crisis as a teacher where it felt like we just elected or reelected, knowing all the facts, this wildly anti-public education governor. I'm a public school teacher. So I joke, but it's true. I found myself the day after on my plan period looking at a job posting for an international school in Kazakhstan, and I have no memory of getting to that website. I just remember sort of catching myself in that moment, like, oh my gosh, is this how bad it is? But as I kind of adjusted to the new reality, I think I just felt like I hadn't done enough to change that outcome or to help my state politically. And that led to some soul searching and a lot of cups of coffee with people who knew more about local politics than I did, and eventually led to me running for the state house in 2016.
Yeah, you're not the first public school teacher I've talked to on this podcast. A few months ago, I spoke with James Cooper. He's a public school teacher at Oklahoma City. And we've seen in Oklahoma, obviously in Kansas, like you said, in West Virginia, and I think a few other states, teachers who just want to do their jobs, because it's a tough job, suddenly getting extremely politically engaged, because it seems like a lot of right-wing state governments seem fine with cutting back on education, and it's engaging people on an issue that maybe hadn't been getting enough attention in the last few years. Is that pretty accurate?
Yeah, you know, what I saw, so my background as an educator, I studied to teach high school history, but I ended up getting a job teaching elementary English language learners, which was great. I had experience doing, teaching English to non-native speakers, but I didn't have an elementary school experience. And so when I got in that building, I was just in awe of, it seemed like, the magic that my veteran colleagues could perform with, you know, a class of 25, 7-year-olds. My first year, like most first year teachers, I was just trying to keep my head above water. But I just remember when I get to interact with those veteran teachers, just how much skill and talent you see. And then I would see them considering leaving the profession. And it wasn't because of pay so much. I mean, most people go into teaching know they're not going to make a ton of money, which I think we should change, but that wasn't at least a motivating factor for people leaving. It was that they didn't have the resources to keep up with the needs of their students. And so, you know, what you used to be able to get done in a year with 20 students in your class was now impossible to accomplish with, you know, increasing needs of students in a class of 26 students. And I just felt like I don't know how to do the magic that they do with the students, but perhaps advocating for my fellow teachers and public education in general was a way I could have an impact on that. And I think that's been a common experience for a lot of teachers, that, you know, decisions are being made above their pay grade, but they're not going to sit idly by when things are affecting their students.
Yeah, I come from a pretty well-funded school district, but we're talking to my son just started kindergarten this year, and the teacher was explaining kindergarten to all of us parents, and she said, so, you know, kindergarten, school's not like what you remember. Kindergarten is now basically what first grade was when you were in school. First grade's what second grade was. The expectations are so much higher at every grade level, and what we're asked of is tougher and different. So, you know, you as a parent, and then, of course, as a voter, people who are parents or grandparents, you know, who haven't been in school for a while, they don't realize that the expectations of education are so different than from 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, you layer in that, especially, I mean, not every school district, but most do have just increasing needs for students, right? If their parents have to work two jobs, they may not get read to at home as much.
Right.
There may be language challenges. We're seeing increasing incidences of just extra mental health supports that are needed. I mean, the schools are asked to do considerably more, and you're right, sometimes at a faster rate as far as what's being covered each year. And so when you throw in bigger class sizes or not enough teachers going into the profession to accommodate that, yeah, it all compounds and makes life a lot more difficult for everyone.
So that was a main motivation. And from following politics, it seemed like for a lot of voters, education and those cuts, and to healthcare as well, seemed to be a big motivator for voters in Kansas in the last few years, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that, at least in 2016, was one of the really encouraging things, that it was kind of a bipartisan motivation. So in Kansas, there's long been sort of this, it's an imperfect explanation, but people talk about there being three political parties. There's Democrats, there's a little bit more moderate Republicans, and then there's kind of far-right Republicans. In the 2016 primaries, the moderate Republicans really made a strong comeback. You had first-time candidates beating incumbents in the primary in August, and then we combined that with pretty big Democratic gains in November. So there was, across the aisle at least, a broad realization that what was happening wasn't working, that, you know, regardless of how everyone might feel on other issues, that, you know, underfunding schools was not going to make our state stronger or better in any way. And so that was really encouraging to see that, you know, to be going to candidate events with people who are running as Republicans, but you're using the same talking points, you agree on some of those big issues. I think that was a unique experience that a lot of people going into partisan politics probably don't get.
It was a unique experience that you'd never run before, and you decided to for these reasons. Did you feel that you were prepared for what was to come? Did you know what was expected for you as a candidate?
That's a really good question. In Kansas, our races are so small. It's almost all amateur efforts at this level. So for better or worse, there's a lot of self-teaching for candidates. Mm-hmm. There are some resources out there, but if you're brand new like I was, sometimes it's hard to know where to go find them, and you don't know what you don't know. You know, for me, it was getting five or six or seven smart people I knew who lived in the area to sit around a coffee shop every Friday evening, and we just think out loud about what the next month and the month after that should look like in the campaign. And none of us were experts, but, you know, just through conversation and hopefully weeding out the worst ideas that we came up with, we ended up doing all right. Now, in hindsight, I can see a lot of things we probably could have done more professionally and been a little bit more precise and may have had a better result, but in the end, it was good enough for that cycle, and we made it through. One of the things I'm trying to do as an incumbent now is help some of our new first-time candidates with sort of that institutional knowledge that you just can't have unless you've done it before.
Right, and I think that's something that no one's ever fully prepared for running for office, even if you've knocked on doors for other candidates before, right? Like, you're doing this for yourself. It's a weird feeling when you're asking people to vote for you for the first time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's unlike anything I've done in my life as far as just stretching me and whether I like it or not, forcing some personal growth. You learn really quickly the things that are easier than expected and the things that, you know, you loathe doing, like for me, picking up the phone and calling people and asking them for campaign contributions is one where I don't think any amount of experience will make me like that more, but you realize that's how, what it takes to get regular people elected, and you do the parts that are a challenge for you, and you revel, hopefully, in the parts that are more fun, and hope you can get by that way.
So, but like you said, in Kansas, you can elect regular people. So in Florida, for example, I think there have been state legislative races that cost in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And in Pennsylvania, where I am, there's some races that cost, actually, they do cost like $100,000 or more.
Right.
That's not the case where you are, right? You do have to raise money, but you don't have to raise, you know, the sum of a few houses.
Yeah, so my first race, I knew almost no one with lots of disposable income, especially as a teacher and a fairly young one. So on the backs of $20 and $50 contributions, I scraped together, I think, just around $30,000 for that race.
That's a lot.
On the lower end of winning totals, but, you know, somewhere in the $40,000 to $50,000 is probably the average, and then I was a little higher than that for re-election. But, yeah, I think I just saw one of the Virginia races this November set a record where the combined spend by the two candidates, I think, was over $3 million.
I can't. Like, it's just insane. But, like, that's the thing about the country right now, to me, is if you're a Democrat, if you care about these issues, or even if you're a moderate and you want to get away from the craziness of what's going on with the Trump type of Republican system, you need to compete everywhere. And there are a lot of places to compete, including in Kansas, that shouldn't just be ignored because it's more affordable to win there, even if it might be a little bit harder to win over some people.
Yeah, you're preaching my message. I'm on the campaign committee this year for the House Democratic Caucus, so this is a message I've been carrying to a lot of individuals and partner organizations. They, you know, yes, it's wonderful that we're 9 seats away from flipping the Texas State House, and I'm all for efforts to do so. But if you have a little change left over after that, it goes a long way in Kansas. And, you know, literally $10,000 spent on the right race could be the difference in Kansas between a conservative Republican supermajority or not. And actually, that has pretty massive policy implications for us because we elected a Democratic governor last time, too. So lots of issues could be decided by just a really, really small amount of money in Kansas for the next 2 years.
Yeah, and that's why I personally like an organization called Run for Something, runforsomething.net, where they're winning a lot of races for a lot of diverse candidates because they're encouraging people to run in places where people might not have tried.
Right. Well, I think what we see is if you try everywhere, it means everyone else has to try everywhere. They can't just pick and choose which races they pour their money into or they put their time and energy to, and then you get some kind of fun, surprising, long-shot victories where no one ever thought it was possible.
Now, the one thing you also said about running is that there's a lot of regular people who can run in Kansas, and I think for so many people in the public, they think that politicians are this alien race, that they're so different, but you realize once you're in there, people might be weird or goofy, but people are weird and goofy everywhere. And you realize that, like, these are human beings who are just as smart / dumb / normal / great. Like, they're just like everyone else, but they have this job.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was one of the biggest takeaways from my experience. We tend to imagine these grand barriers to serving. And I don't want to discount it. There are some real ones. Like, in Kansas, it's hard to be a state legislator and make a living wage. There are limitations, but one of them that I think we tend to put in front of it is, you know, you have to have vast political experience or a law degree or, I don't know, successfully started 9 small businesses or whatever barriers we put in our head because we haven't interacted with it. And really, it is just different people who are motivated by different issues and decided this was a thing that they wanted to do. I think one of the most encouraging things for me running was just to go to the state house and sit in the audience for some committee hearings, and I think, well, what would I say to this question, or what would I want to ask about this? And you just kind of realize, oh, well, this is not, there's not any grand mystery to it. It's just people who've decided that this is a thing that they can make a difference at, and they stepped up and did it.
Right, and if you're listening and you're thinking about why isn't my state legislature or my Congress or my city council taking up this issue, it's probably because you, the person thinking it, aren't the one there, either in office or bringing it up, because it's just different people doing it. It doesn't matter the party so much at that point.
Yeah, you know, that was, I think, one of the empowering but terrifying revelations about 2 or 3 months into my first session was that it's highly possible any one of us might think of something that, you know, there's 125 House members in Kansas, that on any given day, something might occur to one of us that didn't occur to the other 124, and that might move, you know, the direction of a major policy. Someone might ask the right question, and so it really does matter, no matter what your background or political history, to get to be a part of that, because you probably bring a perspective that may not be represented there, and regardless of party affiliation or the makeup of the legislature, everything works better if you have more perspectives to bring to bear on a problem.
So, but we're talking about people, and the people in Kansas are not exactly the monolith that people outside of Kansas may think. Like you said, you have a Democratic governor, you have moderate Republicans, far-right Republicans, Democrats, and you have a contentious Senate race this year. We were tweeting back and forth. There was a letter about from someone in Kansas, a Republican, who said they had to switch their party registration because they didn't want to affiliate with what was going on anymore. So, is Kansas changing in ways that people don't realize?
I think so. You know, after last election, we had two Republican state senators and one Republican in the state house switch parties because they were being so forced out of their own party. In fact, one of those state senators is now one of our candidates for U.S. Senate. And I saw this a lot with voters that I talked to. You know, in 2016, I would go to Republican doors, and they were frustrated with Governor Brownback, and it was like they were willing to give up their party loyalty for the one vote for the state house, and that was a big concession. But you know, they met me, and they didn't meet the other person, and they liked that I was for public education, and so we could have that conversation around one race. This past cycle, 2018, when I went to the doors, it was probably twice a week I'd hear from a Republican family, and they'd say, "You know what? We've always voted for Republicans, but this year we can't vote for any of them. We're so disgusted with what's going on." And I didn't have to make my case. They just asked if I was a Democrat and said, "Great, we're voting for you." We're seeing that a lot in my area. It's sort of the prototypical higher educated suburb that's changing around the country. That said, there are red areas in Kansas that are getting redder, and it will be interesting to see how that all sorts itself out over the next couple of cycles.
Right, but if the right areas can move in the right direction, you can win over seats, because a conservative area that just gets more conservative, you know, just might elect a different Republican, but you know, if you're able to flip some areas or even get more moderate Republicans in other areas, that's a big win.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think the success of our governor winning the last election, too, was really indicative that Kansans, regardless of party, they want someone competent. They want someone probably closer to the center than the Republicans were offering as well. We're lucky to have Laura Kelly elected governor. In fact, this is not something you think about Kansas, but we're the only state in the nation that has elected three Democratic women as governors. Our last three Democratic governors have been women, and not Massachusetts, not California, but Kansas. So sometimes the results in places we tend to write off can surprise us.
Yeah, certainly not Pennsylvania. Until recently, with electing four women to Congress, we've not had a good reputation in Pennsylvania of electing women, especially statewide. Very, very few. And that needs to change. But that does remind me of a couple other women I've talked to in this podcast, including Jill Schiller. She ran for Congress in Ohio, and it was a tough race. She had very uphill, didn't win, but she was starting to spread a lot of Democratic ideas. She didn't just run as a Republican, but with a Democrat next to her name type of thing.
Sure.
And it seemed like what was successful for her, even though she didn't win, was that she was kind of seeding the ground for ideas so that some people may move and they might vote for Democrats in the future elections or in other statewide or other elections that are also at the same ballot. So maybe state legislator or whatnot. Do you think that's something in Kansas too, where the more Democrats that are running, the more it's going to help evolve the party and bring people along both for this term and for the future?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the candidates who take on that hard task of trying to build for the future, even when it's a really uphill race for their own, do not get nearly enough credit. I hope they realize for themselves the great work that they're doing, and they really do lay the foundational groundwork for everyone else. I talked with a couple of our candidates after the 2018 cycles who were just running in places where, you know, the party registration situation was 3 or 4 to 1 against them, and they were really uphill shots. But just let them know, you know, what that meant, what their on the ground efforts meant towards electing a Democratic governor, and in our case, in our area, a Democratic congresswoman. You know, it certainly doesn't feel good to lose 60-40 instead of 65-35. But those votes really do make a difference up and down the ballot, even if your own race isn't the one that's successful. And over the long term, we need that everywhere. And I think one of the most fun things to see is when regular people step up and get involved, they tend to bring others like them along in the process, like the candidates, right? People who are in your life think, oh, this is novel. I never knew anyone who ran for office. And then they get out and they knock on doors where they never have before, or they learn how to be your finance director, which they would have never thought of before. All of that work really compounds and makes a difference whether or not you end up with more votes than your opponents for that particular cycle.
Right. We've seen so many people, you follow the presidential campaign now, people who were inspired by either Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders in past elections, and they ran for something because they worked on that campaign or they were a volunteer, and suddenly they're active in their party. And that's true with Republicans too, of course, but that's the people who work on those staffs usually don't do one thing and then they get out of politics.
Right, right. Yeah, if you care enough to take those first steps, it tends to keep you in for life.
So, yeah, it's really hard to get out of. I've been doing this for about 20 years now in some way or another. So you are trying to get things passed, trying to elect people. What do you hope to accomplish in Kansas, whether this year in 2020 or, you know, in the next couple years?
Yeah, we have, I think, two main tasks ahead of us in Kansas. A lot of our work over the last 3 years has been trying to rebuild from really kind of disastrous financial situation in our state.
Right.
So it's not terribly exciting, but just continuing to budget responsibly while reinvesting in programs that were dramatically underfunded is important work every year, probably. I mean, it's always important, but especially coming out of the situation we were in. And thankfully, our governor, Governor Kelly, is a big budget nerd, and is very good at that. So continuing to support that work is important. And then the other big issue, this is one a lot of places, is expanding Medicaid. Kansas is one of, I think, 16 states left that has not. We've literally left, I think, more than $3 billion on the table. We've got hospitals closing in rural counties all over the place. And we frustratingly have had a majority of legislators who supported for many years, but not the will from the conservative legislative leadership to actually allow the vote. So that'll be a big issue.
It's really disconcerting to me. I work for people who are with diseases. I know people with disabilities. There was a book, and I don't need to get into the race stuff, but necessarily with Kansas, but it's called Dying of Whiteness, and it's about people voting against their best interests. Because of all the stuff on Fox News and the campaigns, and that states that have voted against Medicaid expansion have shorter, everyone in the state ends up with a shorter lifespan of about 7 months on average or something like that. So you're losing,
yeah, I mean,
you're losing life.
It really is amazing. It's at this point we're 6-7 years into having these arguments, and there's not much reason on the other side other than someone can label it Obamacare on the next election postcard. And again, the maddening thing in Kansas is we've got 60-65% of legislators, a bipartisan group, who would pass it, but the Speaker of the House doesn't support it, and the Senate President doesn't support it, and at the end of the day, they wield quite a bit of power on what gets a vote and what doesn't.
It's crazy to me, too, knowing that, like, Donald Trump just on a whim will decide that Sundays are now called Turkey Days. And so if he decided, like, We're going to call Medicaid expansion Trump Care. Just that part of the Affordable Care Act. We're going to keep Medicaid expansion, call it Trump Care. All these states that didn't pass it would now pass it, right?
Right. Oh, absolutely. I think the thing that has always stood out to me was if the dollars that were being offered for, say, an infrastructure project, every state in the nation would have passed it the first second that it became available. I serve on two budget committees, and the amount of time we talk about being able to draw down federal matching dollars for the things that we invest in is laughable when you think about most of those are 1-to-1 or 2-to-1 matches. Medicaid expansion is a 9-to-1 match.
Right.
I mean, everyone's already paying for it in their federal taxes. It's just a matter of which states choose to bring those tax dollars back home. If it wasn't literally a matter of life and death for a lot of people, it would be almost funny that Kansas instead chooses to subsidize Medicaid expansion in a lot of blue states rather than bring their tax dollars home. But it's almost nonsensical, but that doesn't make it any less tragic.
Well, I'm glad that you're getting things done. Now, we've talked a lot about how you're helping people run for office. The podcast is called You Should Run. 2020 is a couple weeks away from when this is recording and when this is posted. Why should more people run for office for whatever election?
I would say you should run because it makes a difference whether it's your race or down the road. I'm going to butcher it a little bit, but one of my favorite quotes is a Bobby Kennedy quote, and it's the tiny ripples of hope that each time someone stands up against injustice, they create tiny ripples of hope, and those combine to knock down the mightiest walls of oppression. Losing races make an impact. Winning races make an impact. People need something to get involved with. They need to be organized. They need to be given a reason to turn out and vote, and you can be a part of that, win or lose. But the other thing is there are a lot of constituencies that are vastly underrepresented at all levels of government. So if you've thought about running, keep thinking about it. Keep talking with more people. Most of the barriers we put in front of getting it done are imagined. There are some real ones. There are financial choices that have to be made to run a campaign or to serve in low-paid elected office. But don't let that be the end of the thought process. And if you can't be the person who runs, then be a person who's encouraging great people in your life to make the run and be a part of their campaigns. It doesn't get better unless we put in the work, and like it or not, much of the work is running campaigns and finding great candidates.
Well, I appreciate what you're doing. I wish you luck in Kansas. I know what can get done, and I have faith that you guys are going to get a lot done there in the next few years.
Well, thank you. We're optimistic about it, but yeah, a lot of work to be done.
All right, before we go, one last thing. If people are interested in following you and learning more about Kansas, where should they go?
Yeah, so I'm BrettParkerForKansas.com is my website. At BrettParker, the number 4KS, is me on Twitter. On Facebook, it's just BrettParkerForKansas. I'm pretty active on social media, especially during the legislative session. Twitter is probably the place to get the most up-to-date news, and if you're just a big nerd about what's going on in Kansas, politics, hashtag KSLEG is the hashtag to follow on social media to get the latest news.
Great. Well, thanks so much. Everyone follow Brett Parker on Twitter. Make sure you're following the right Brett Parker because it's a common name. And I wish you the best of luck. And if you're listening, wherever you are, whether you are in Pennsylvania or Alaska or Kansas or anywhere in between, maybe you should consider running for office. Thank you so much, Brett.
Thanks for having me.